First of all, I work as a medical associate on the Engender Health Fistula Care Project, and we provide preventive and curative services in 10 sub-Saharan African countries as well as Bangladesh. To date, we've supported 25,000 fistula repairs. This is complex surgery that requires high levels of technical skill. So the aim of my presentation is to draw attention to this neglected group of women and to highlight some of the practical ethical dilemmas we and others in the field have encountered in seeking to meet the needs of these women. It's also of broader relevance to clinicians and program planners in low-resource settings because it echoes many of the considerations which need to be taken into account when making complex and potentially life-changing decisions and allocating scarce resources for vulnerable populations. The content is based on discussions and recommendations from an expert meeting we held in collaboration with the Harvard Humanitarian Initiative, whose purpose was to reach agreement on recommendations for global minimum standards on care. And when we talk about participatory, it included experts, but not women with incurable fistula. I don't have any interest to declare. So just to briefly let you know what obstetric fistula is. So it's a devastating childbirth injury that arises indirectly from poverty and gender discrimination. It's generally been eradicated in the West, but it persists in sub-Saharan Africa in what are called the fistula belt countries, also in South Asia and in Southeast Asia. It's generally preventable, and the vast majority are from obstetric causes, obstructed labour, but a small amount are traumatic, resulting from sexual violence. An increasing proportion are iatrogenic from provider error with increasing cesarean section rates. So obstructed labour remains a major and underreported cause of maternal and newborn mortality in low-resource settings, and it's estimated to account for about 8% of maternal deaths, maybe more. We don't really know because we don't have the evidence base. Fistula occurs in countries where maternal mortality is high and health management information systems are generally quite poor. But the most frequently cited estimate is around 2 million prevalent cases, with around 50 to 100,000 new cases each year. So if women are lucky enough to survive childbirth, they may end up with a fistula. And the diagram on the left shows how this occurs. So when a woman has been in labor for many hours or even days, the pressure of the baby's head on the soft tissues cuts off the blood supply, and eventually that tissue dies and a hole forms, which leaves the woman leaking, usually urine, but maybe also feces as well. And in most cases, those women don't have a live baby to show for their horrendous ordeal. So I've used this slide because it's a very powerful description of this group of women. It's women with very complex injuries who are desperate for a cure, and the cloud of women are a constant reminder to providers of their failure to provide one. So most clinicians would agree with this definition of incurable fistula, and out of the group of women living with fistula, the estimate of women with incurable fistula is variably said to be between 3 and 5%. So what does it actually mean to be incurable? What does it mean and what makes it incurable? In our meeting title, we deliberately use the word deemed incurable, and that's an important descriptor, and it highlights the influence of a variety of factors, physical, cultural, and contextual, that influence the curability of fistula. For example, with advances in surgical techniques or with greater resources and improved surgical skills, means that a woman who's currently cast as incurable may be incurable in another context or in the future. So what are the implications? Incurable, inoperable, irreparable, they're all terms that carry a sense of depressing finality, and an analogy might be to be given a diagnosis of terminal cancer or terminal AIDS. There's nothing more that can be done for these women in many of these contexts. So what are a woman's options if she can't be cured? Well, without surgical treatment, she's really condemned to a life where she's constantly wet, smells horrible, and because incontinence products are expensive and not generally available in these settings, women use rags, which they launder very often, so they get very hard, and that leads to horrible skin infections and ulcerations. They also use bleach to disinfect the rags, and that increases the skin irritation. They often end up with renal failure because they try to limit their fluid intake to reduce the incontinence. And inevitably, they are often rejected and ostracized by their husbands, families, and communities. So the surgical options, this group of procedures called urinary diversion, and the aim of them is to divert the urinary flow to either into the colon or sometimes onto the abdomen, and that may include having to use stoma, to have a stoma. Again, you can see that these are very complex surgeries and that they require long-term follow-up, and in some cases stoma supplies, which are expensive and not generally available in these settings. But one of the most important factors is that generally these surgeries are not culturally acceptable. Although some fistula surgeons would consider successful urinary diversion as a viable option compared to the alternative. So I'd like to return to the women again. I think we want to bear in mind that these women are survivors, not victims. Although a lot has been written about women with women with fistula generally as victims, sufferers, vulnerable and fragile, and they're usually extremely poor by our standards, often very young, often illiterate, and for women whose fistula is deemed incurable, they may also have been through a number of traumatic surgeries previously. But they're also survivors, and they've survived childbirth, and they're able to understand and navigate their world in ways that we, as the so-called experts, may not really understand, and their priorities may be very different from what clinicians would advise. So while the primary purpose of our meeting was to set minimum standards, we also wanted to try and change the paradigm of care from treating women as passive victims to putting them at the centre of our discussions as women who are resourceful and creative and who have agency. So we decided to try and find an ethical framework that might more holistically address these women's needs, and to explore what really matters to them beyond clinical management and in the context of real lives lived in poverty and with scarce resources available. So we decided to try using Johnson, Siegler and Winslade's four-box method. I'm sure that many of you in the room are more than familiar with this framework, which it applies classical bioethical principles to practical perspectives in clinical care. And the boxes are intended to help providers and program planners to make decisions about client care. So I'm going to go into the boxes in more detail. Well, as many people would say, context is everything. And I think I've already referred to the fact that by definition, fistulas occur and fistula treatment takes place in low-resource settings where inadequate resources and supplies are the norm. Fistula surgeons are in very short supply. A lot of fistula treatment is provided in outreach camp settings, which brings up a number of ethical issues about follow-up and informed decision-making. And obviously with a camp setting, there is, as I think I just said, limited follow-up. So going on to medical indications, the underlying principle for this box would be when considering medical condition and treatment options, do the options fulfill the goal of medical care? So what's the likelihood of success? And if not, is the treatment proposed possibly futile? So what constitutes success for obstetric fistula? Well, it's generally acknowledged to be closed and dry, but this is a relatively narrow clinical definition. So people have proposed this 5W criteria for clinical decision making, and I won't go through them, I think they're clear. And then moving on to how we would go about looking at quality of life and patient preferences. Well, we certainly don't know enough about these aspects, and the evidence base is tiny. What would matter to women making a decision about their care? You know, what would they need to know about their likely quality of life after treatment? And would she be able to take part in family life or to do any of the things that I've got on the slide, really? Then moving on to patient preferences, we need to consider, what does the patient want? I'm going to discuss informed and voluntary decision making in the next slide. But in terms of body image, as you've seen, I've talked about very complex surgeries. So women need to know, you know, how will she look after these, if she goes ahead with this kind of surgery? What will she be letting herself in for? Is there going to be something about her appearance that's so different that it's unacceptable to her? And many women have said that they don't want to pass urine and stool like a chicken, that having an abdominal stoma would be totally unacceptable to them. And then socially, would she be able to fit back into whatever environment she's come from, and what might help her to do that? And of course, none of this may even be relevant if women perceive the quality of care to be low or fear that they're going to be treated unkindly, in which case they may just simply opt out of treatment and disappear to survive as best they can, and that's what happens to many of these women. So moving on to the challenge of informed and voluntary decision making in these kind of contexts. So as I said, these women are desperate for a cure, but they need to make very difficult decisions about complex treatment options, which may have a profound effect on their lives. They need to be clear about the options, but the context in which this decision making takes place is often very inadequate. They've only got a one-time chance, usually, to have an explanation, and it's probably very time-limited. There are all sorts of language and cultural barriers. Often Western surgeons are coming to provide surgery, but they obviously don't share the culture or the language. And then there's most fistula surgeons are male, all the patients are women, and very poor. Those are the problems. And then another debate that goes on is, how much information is too much information, and should we apply Western standards to this process? And is it unethical not to? So then, firstly, I must say that providers in the field of fistula work in incredibly challenging environments, and we should give credit to the many inspirational providers for their commitment and passion in trying to improve these women's lives. And to their credit, fistula surgeons have already addressed the need for a code of ethics, generally for fistula surgery, not specifically for incurable fistula. But it's still a very difficult area, because there's a big pressure on providers to do something for the poor women as against doing no harm. So providers often do get quite burnt out. And then there are the issues of the feasibility, safety and follow-up of complex fistula surgery, and the issue of what has been termed fistula tourism, where Western surgeons come to do heroic surgeries in settings that they wouldn't be able to do in the West because of litigation and accountability. So that is an issue. So just moving on to the conclusions. Accepting that we don't have all the answers, the recommendations that came out of our meeting was that clearly there's a critical need for standards and guidelines, but the guidelines may need to be very context specific, because there are very different situations in different countries that we work in. We thought we needed to establish a credentialing system for providers because we know that a woman's first shot at treatment is her best chance of success, and that complex fistula surgery shouldn't be attempted by inexperienced clinicians. We definitely do need to expand the evidence base, as some people have said, from eminence-based to evidence-based practice. And we need a lot more qualitative research into women's experience of fistula. We also need to review the existing decision-making tools for women. I think we need to involve women a lot more in understanding what their concerns are and how we would set about developing such a decision-making tool. And then finally, as many people say, what is not counted does not count. These women are invisible, and so people have suggested that we could raise the profile by either getting the WHO ICD classification to include obstetric fistula and incurable obstetric fistula as a notifiable condition, or some people have even suggested that it could be classed as a neglected tropical disease or a non-communicable disease. So that's it, really. I'd be very grateful if you would check out our website, and we've written a report on the meeting that I based my presentation on, which might be interesting to ethicists.
We do have time for questions, please.
Yeah.
Hi. Just a quick one. You mentioned that there's
been
a recent breeze through the suggestion of credentialing, and that's something that comes up a lot in global health, global surgery world. And I'm interested to hear how you're going to do that.
Yes. Well, I don't, like I said, we don't have all the answers. This is actually the first meeting that we've held to look, that's sort of ever been held to look at these issues. There's the International Association of Fistula Surgeons is having their congress next month, and this is one of the issues that will come up, how this could actually be implemented or even developed. Because there's, in the first instance, there's a really big shortage of fistula surgeons because, as you can imagine, it's not necessarily a very attractive career option because there's no money in it. So attrition is a big problem. But I think some of potential avenues would be to just confine this kind of surgical treatment to centres of excellence, where it would be perhaps easier to keep track of the surgeons operating in that way to develop a... I'm not really answering your question, actually.
Sorry,
I understand.
I think it's a horrendously bad idea.
Do you?
Yes. We can talk more later.
Sure. I'm not a fistula surgeon, as I must say. I'm only a midwife, and... This was the fistula surgeons came up with this idea because they felt that one of the major problems was that inexperienced surgeons, because of the pressure to do something, were tackling tackling fistula that they should never have laid hands on, and they just, you know, as I said, it's the first try is the best chance of success, and you just muck things up. I mean, I'm not even laughing because it's absolutely terrible.
No,
what happens. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm on the other side of the curtain, but yeah.
Right.
Are there data on suicide and depression?
Well, like I said, the evidence base is tiny. Clearly, I think it's very likely, as with all reproductive morbidities, if you just look, for example, at uterine prolapse, I've just been looking at uterine prolapse in Nepal, for example, and suicide resulting from chronic or really extreme uterine prolapse is very high. So we simply don't know what happens to these women. They actually disappear. And, you know, that slide I showed of women hanging around hospital compounds, we have so little information about what happens to them, what their life expectancy is, how they get by.
Thank you very much.